And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and it is a special privilege today to be able to welcome to Dads on the Air, Hugh McKay. Hugh is a social researcher and best-selling author. Australia Reimagined is his 19th book, and his research career has spanned six decades, including 25 years as research director of the McKay Report, publishing quarterly reports on all aspects of Australian life. Among many other appointments, he is a fellow of the Australian Psychological Society and has been awarded honorary doctorates by five Australian universities. In 2015, he was appointed an officer of the Order of Australia. Hugh McKay, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thank you very much, Bill. Lovely to be back.
After this career spanning 60 years of experience listening to Australians talk about their lives and watching trends and your 19 books, where are we now in Australia?
I think we're in a rather difficult situation. It's a contradictory situation because on the one hand, we're being told we've had 26 years of uninterrupted economic growth. Life has never been better. Isn't it an exciting time to be here? On the other hand, we're dealing with a greater chasm of income inequality than we've ever had. And perhaps most disturbing, Bill, we're dealing with what I think we should call an epidemic of anxiety and depression, which indicates that all of this economic prosperity, which is terrific if you're in the top half of the economic heap, is not actually producing a more contented society. I think apart from the obvious signs of widespread mental illness and particularly the anxiety disorder, we've lost faith in many of our institutions like politics, the churches, the banks, big business, trade unions, and there's a general sense in the community at the moment, I suppose a sense of uneasiness, some disappointment that when things should be going so well, they're not going so well for so many of us. And of course, there are sort of blots on our conscience, I think, that we're still coming to terms with. We still haven't resolved issues to do with our treatment of Indigenous Australians. We still haven't worked out what to do with all the people who are still stranded in our offshore detention centres because they dared to seek asylum here, which was a perfectly legal thing for them to do. So I don't want to sound too bleak. We're also, of course, suffering from an epidemic of obesity. We're about to become the world's fattest nation. That isn't good news either. But, I mean, there are plenty of other things we can brag about. But I do think it's an interesting, rather turbulent period that we're in right at the moment. I mean, for example, how do we, in 2018, live with the fact that 16% of our kids under the age of 15 do not have regular and reliable access to safe and nutritious food? And how do we account for the fact that our school education standards have been steadily slipping to the point where an international study last year ranked us, I think it was the world's 30 richest or most affluent nations, and we came in number 29th out of 30 in terms of school performance. So you know, we could go on and on with the balance sheet, but overall, I think the central thing that disturbs me is the epidemic of anxiety and what I think of, Bill, as the primary underlying cause of that, which is that we're a more socially fragmented society than we've ever been, and there are many reasons for that, which we can talk about.
The situation in Australia is there are these problems that you've mentioned, and in perhaps in previous times we might have gone to one of the institutions that you named. I mean, we might have gone to the church, we might have gone looked to our politicians, we might have even looked to our families, but all these institutions seem to be breaking down.
Yes, that's true, and it's going to be absolutely fascinating. I wish I was going to be around for the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. I don't think I will be, but it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see how we deal with this. I mean, I think there are a couple of things we can see already which are positive signs. One is, as people become a bit jaundiced about the quality of leadership, both in politics but also in business and finance and so on, more and more people look to the local neighbourhood and say, well, okay, we can't wave a magic wand and fix all Australia's problems, but we could make sure that in our local neighbourhood, our local community, we are living the way we think Australians should live. And that goes right to this point about social fragmentation and increasing social isolation, with, as you say, the breakdown of the family. About 35% of contemporary marriages ending in divorce. We're a more mobile population than we used to be. Our households are shrinking. Every fourth household now in Australia contains only one person. So there's a huge potential epidemic of social isolation and loneliness. I noticed the UK government has recently appointed a minister for loneliness because they've got the same problem. So when people start to say, well, these are real social issues, I mean, if people become more socially fragmented, if there is a greater problem of social isolation, we will inevitably have an epidemic of anxiety, because we're social beings, you know, we're herd animals. If people are cut off from the herd, if they don't feel as if they belong in a local neighbourhood or community, their anxiety level is bound to rise. So I think that realisation that's coming to more and more Australians, and there are some brilliant examples of it, that we've got to do something about the life of the local neighbourhood. You know, I think the best way to judge the health of the nation is to look at the health of our local neighbourhoods. Are we acting like neighbours? Have we made sure we know the people who live next door? Have we been alert to the fact that someone in our street might be living alone, might be a bit frail or elderly and need a bit of support, or even just a friendly chat every now and then? Are we making sure no one is left out? Because that's what being a member of this species really involves.
Yes, you referred there to the anxiety that's so widespread these days. But fortunately, you mentioned a couple of things in your book that would be a countermeasure to take to this anxiety. I'm thinking, for instance, you say faith in something bigger than yourself. And maybe that might be one of the clues, if we're living in these apartment blocks and we don't know our neighbours, that we need to look outside ourselves.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think it's always true for humans, and it's particularly true when there is such a widespread problem of anxiety fueled by social isolation. We need to look. What have been the traditional sort of antidotes to anxiety through human history? And you've just mentioned a key one, Bill, which is faith in something beyond ourselves. Martin Seligman, the psychologist famous for establishing the positive psychology movement, he's often written that the one absolutely essential requirement for people to have a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives is that they should have placed their faith in something greater than themselves. And he's not recommending religious faith necessarily, although through human history it's mainly been faith in one God or another that has sustained people. But it might be faith in the power of love, or it might be faith in the nation, or it might be faith in an institution, although, as we've already commented, faith in institutions is waning a bit at the moment. Might be faith in the family, or faith in the idea of justice or goodness or something. But something beyond the self is crucial for us. A couple of other antidotes that are worth mentioning. contact with the natural world. You mentioned people in high-rise apartments. A great challenge for people who are in high-density living is to make sure that they do have contact with the natural world, that they do go walking in parks or along the beach or climbing mountains, or that they get their kids out onto the grass and climbing trees and kicking a ball around. So the contact, because obviously we are sort of indivisible from the earth, we're all part of this ecosystem, so it's not surprising that contact with the earth is crucial to our mental health. But, of course, so also, apart from the faith in something bigger and the contact with the natural world, the contact with each other, that sense of being, belonging to it, to the power of the community, is very sustaining. And that actually, that needs to be peeled back a little bit. We need to peep into what that actually involves, Bill, because it's not just living somewhere where lots of other people live. It's being part of a community in which people really are looking out for each other, really caring for each other. I think the magic word here is compassion. If we develop the habit, when I say compassion, I'm not thinking about some highly emotional state which we associate with bleeding hearts and do-gooders and so on. I'm talking about what I think of as the most rational response we can make to a realization of what it actually means to be human. Because we're human, we belong to each other. We're all part of the one thing. You know, it often seems as though the differences between you and me are the most interesting thing about us, but actually the most significant thing about us is that we share this common humanity. Therefore, the best way for humans to live is to treat each other kindly and with respect, and that's what I mean by compassion. And there is no doubt, I mean, it doesn't just make sense, it's demonstrated in lots of people's research. There is no doubt that people who develop the discipline of compassion, of looking out for other people, responding to other people's needs, being alert to the other people in their neighborhood, do enjoy better mental health. Their anxiety, nothing steadies the emotions, nothing gets your anxiety level down more quickly than having to focus on someone else's needs. We know that in an emergency, you know, if there's a fire or a flood or a storm or something and people need help, we just rush out. We act like neighbors. The challenge for us is to act like neighbors all the time, and that's good for us as well as good for our neighbors. So there are some of the things that through history have been shown to be great anxiety relievers. And there is a fourth, Bill, which is probably worth mentioning, and that's creative self-expression. It's obviously very good for us to sing and dance and write poetry and tell stories and take photographs and do things that give our creative spirit a bit of expression. That again, that's therapeutic for us because it takes our minds off ourselves and just lets the creative spirit flow through us.
We seem to have gone down the wrong track, and I think the first time I saw this criticised was by Robert Kennedy a long time ago, but we need a new economic model rather than GDP, the gross domestic product. We need to be able to measure those things you were just talking about, the creative self-expression and doing good in the community rather than just the dollars and cents.
Yes, I think that's true, and various people have tried to develop ways of measuring that. It's very hard to measure all these things. I mean, there are now various countries in the world that measure what they call a happiness index or a well-being index as an alternative to GDP. I applaud those efforts, although I think it is a very difficult thing to measure. But I think what's required is a different mindset, especially among our leaders. I mean, I think many of us can remember when we used to live in a society, and now we feel as if we live in an economy where all decisions seem to be made on economic grounds, and the constant talk is about economic matters. Politicians are always talking about economics, about tax cuts and balancing budgets and all that stuff. And that's all, of course, that's important. But it's only important as the underpinning for the kind of society we want to live in. I think all of us would yearn for more talk at the top about the kind of society we want to become and how we can get there. And yes, of course, part of that story will be that we've got to manage the economy to allow that to happen. In particular, you would think we've got to start looking at the problem of income inequality, which is leading to massive social inequality, and see how we can correct that. And that's an economic challenge for us that doesn't seem to get much airing at the moment. But I think you're right. I think it's important for economists to measure GDP and for all of those figures to be analysed properly. But let's remember what the purpose is. Running a healthy economy is not an end in itself. It's simply to create the foundation for a healthy society.
And I think, as you point out, we can't just sit around and wait for our leaders to do this, because really great leaders are fairly rare on the ground, aren't they? It's certainly
yes,
in the world today.
That's very true. And that's why I'm very heartened by all the stories, and I've told many of them in the new book, of people who are taking initiatives in their local neighbourhoods and communities to encourage people to live as if this is a society, to live as if we are human beings who need each other, and in particular to live as if we understand this central truth about us, which is that my health, especially my mental health, does depend to a very large extent on the health of the neighbourhood that I exist in. For example, feeling as if you can't trust your neighbours because you don't know them, because you haven't spent enough time with them, is a very unhealthy state to be in. The lack of trust, again, drives our feelings of anxiety through the roof. So, yes, I think the more we can start the revolution by thinking local, what could I do in my street to make sure no one is left out? Should we have the occasional street party? Should we start a book club or a community choir or a community garden or current affairs discussion group or something? I mean, there are many people taking these initiatives. There are some, like local libraries, I think, have really risen to the occasion and have become a community hub for many local neighbourhoods and communities, because they provide a lot of activities that do bring people together. But even deciding to patronise the local coffee shop at least once a week, where you'll run into people who live in the district, those sort of, be engaged, you know, join, get active, get connected, and don't spend quite so much time wringing your hands about the state of the nation, but face up to this possibility that the state of the nation actually starts in your street, that we do it street by street. That's how the revolution happens.
And we're speaking today with Hugh McKay, who is the author of Australia Reimagined, Towards a More Compassionate, Less Anxious Society. And Hugh, yes, you say in your book that society's problems really means our problems. It's we can't sort of divorce ourselves from society and sort of lock ourselves away. That's part of the problem, isn't it?
Yes, that's true, Bill, and that's the unhealthiest response if we decide to exist in a little bubble where we only mix with people we like, you know, where we've got a tight little friendship group or a family group, and we don't engage more broadly with the community. That's the worst possible response. I think a good way of thinking about this is to say, let's think about the epidemic of anxiety. Even if you or I might not be experiencing an anxiety disorder at the moment, we are part of the society that has generated this problem. We're all part of the problem of social fragmentation, of the tendency to be more individualistic in our thinking and perhaps even more competitive in our thinking. That drives the problem of social fragmentation, which drives the epidemic of anxiety. So it's our responsibility. I think you've made an excellent point. I think we've got to finally confront this and say, if we think this is an unhealthy state for our society to be in, we've got to own it and start taking the countermeasures.
And in your book, where you do point out some fairly frightening statistics about the level of depression, the level of anxiety in Australia at the moment, and yet I get the sense that there's an overwhelming optimism still in you, Hugh, despite all these years of listening to problems.
Yeah, there is, Bill. I am optimistic, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, I think when a society goes through a rather turbulent time like this, where a lot of people are disenchanted and disillusioned, it's a bit like an individual who goes through a traumatic period, whether it's, you know, perhaps a divorce or a bereavement or a retrenchment, or running into financial difficulties or a life-threatening illness. Most people who go through those traumas look back and say, well, I wouldn't wish that on a dog. That was a terrible experience. But looking back, it helped me to get my priorities sorted out. Or, you know, but people sometimes say it was the making of me, because I really had to pick myself up and rethink what kind of life I wanted to lead. And I think that's true for societies as well. People who lived through wars or depressions or droughts or, you know, appalling challenges to their way of life often look back and say, it was no fun, and I wouldn't want to go through it again, but it was the making of us. So I'm optimistic, because I do think human beings have a great capacity for pulling themselves back from the brink of chaos, and I think we'll do it. You know, I'm confident we will. But to be more specific, the other two sources for optimism are when I talk to young people, the much maligned millennials, you know, sort of 20 people in their 20s and early 30s, this rising generation of young adults, I come away mostly feeling enormous optimism when I talk to them, because, of course, they have had quite a rough ride. They are the offspring of our most divorced ever generation of parents. They've been through periods of great uncertainty. They've been in a competitive education environment. They're facing a challenging job market. They are very well equipped for turbulence and unpredictability. They've grown up with uncertainty and unpredictability, and their sort of generational mantra, in a way, is let's keep our options open. Let's not get too committed too soon. Now, they're criticized for that. They're marrying later. They're having children later. They're buying a house later, if at all. They're making career choices later. They're keeping their options open. Now, I think they're showing the rest of us how best to deal with the kind of uncertain world that we're hurtling into at the moment. So that gives me optimism. But the other thing is part of what we've covered earlier in the conversation, Bill, that I see so many signs around Australia of people who've got that we are in a bit of a mess over all these things, and we do have to start doing something where we live. That sort of local neighbourhood and community initiative, I think, is a terrifically encouraging signpost to a better future for us.
Yes, it's great to hear you speaking like that, Hugh. And we've reached a stage of the program where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick some music for us to play. Would you like to tell us which piece you've picked?
Because the title of the song is The Bluebird. Now, I'm not a sucker for the bluebird of happiness, but it's interesting, isn't it? In our culture, we've got this symbol of the bluebird as a sort of sign of hope and prospect of better days to come and so on. This is a magnificent choral work by an English composer who died early in the 20th century, Charles Villiers Stanford. He wrote a lot of sacred music, but he wrote some beautiful secular works as well, and this is one of his secular songs, The Bluebird.
And that was Opus 119, The Bluebird. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you to our guest today, Hugh McKay, the author of Australia Reimagined. Hugh, thank you very much for being on Dads on the Air.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, Bill.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this program again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.